Bloomberg. The time is 1 p.m. Stay tuned next for Project Censored.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we discuss the ongoing rise of the police state and the prison industrial complex. Longtime social justice activist and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, Carl Dix, joins the program to discuss the latest events involving the police state violence and resistance. Also, the director of the mobilization to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, Jeff Mackler, joins the show to talk about updates concerning Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we complete the program today in discussion with the editor-in-chief of truthout.org, Maya Shenwar. She'll join us to talk about her new book, Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Please stay with us. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we are looking at the police state. We're looking at ongoing issues concerning the prison industrial complex. And we have a few amazing guests that are coming on to share information with us today. We're going to hear updates about what's happening with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And also we're going to be hearing about a new book on the prison system, Locked Down and Locked Out. But Here is Peter to introduce our first guest. I believe we have Carl Dix on the line. Yes, we do. We have Carl Dix on the line. Carl Dix is a co-founder of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He is also a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network with Dr. Cornel West. Carl Dix, you're on the program. How are you?
Thank you for having me on again. I'm doing good.
Carl, what's going on with you right now? You are always, of course, sort of at the center of a lot of movements in social justice, particularly concerning Black Lives Matter and Stop Incarceration. Where are you now and what is happening?
Well, I'm in New York City, and what's happening right now is a national response to the savage murder of Walter Scott on top of all the other murders carried out by police and law enforcement is being planned for April 14th, a nationwide day of disrupting business as usual. I'm sure your audience has largely seen this video, and it is sickening. It's like you're back in the days of slave chasers going after rebellious slaves and murdering them. That's what that cop did in South Carolina. And then calmly seem to be planting evidence in the presence of other cops to justify that murder. And what makes it even worse is that they had written reports based upon the planting of evidence and lying about the circumstances, and the system was well on its way to another justifiable homicide before that video was found.
Carl Dix, hi, this is Peter Phillips.
How you doing, Peter?
I read yesterday Fair had put out a piece about the media immediately jumping on the bandwagon and citing the police department's version of this murder and saying that they had tried to render aid and that Walter Scott had in fact grabbed the taser and the officer, fearing for his life, had to kill him. Of course, the video shows that's a complete lie. And so that's an amazing indictment, not only of the police, but of local media as well.
Yeah, and see, it's the whole system. And we need to be clear, because we have seen this happen again and again and again. Police kill someone, and then their story of how the killing occurred becomes the absolute truth, repeated endlessly by the media, the officials, the DAs, come in with the justifiable homicide. If it's a little too dicey for that, they convene grand juries and walk them through a process that leads to them concluding that the cop committed no crime. The cop says, I feared for my life, and they find a weapon near the body. Now, all of that was set to happen in this, but all of the other times we hear that, like in Ferguson with Darren Wilson killing Michael Brown because he was in fear of his life, with no video that goes unchallenged, case gets closed. We need to be clear that this isn't the only time this has happened. It's just that this time there is a video. And even in the interviews with the young man who took the video, he took it, but he was afraid to go to the authorities with it. And he said, I'll hold it and see if the truth comes out. And as you were recounting, what came out was lies upon lies upon lies from the police, from the media. And then the young man said, well, I'm maybe still scared for my life, but I can't let this cover-up go down.
Well, Carl Dix, the gentleman that recorded the death of Eric Garner, in fact, was arrested and yes. is in jail, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. He is the only one who's gone to jail, the guy who recorded the video, because all of the cops have been exonerated. They've arrested him twice. They put him up on high bail for what really appear to be trumped-up charges. It was a drug bust where they found no drugs, but they still held him for conspiracy to distribute drugs. And his family raised the money to bail him out a few days ago through GoFundMe, went to the authorities with the money. The district attorney refused to accept the bail money because he said he suspected that it may have come from illegal sources. GoFundMe is an illegal source. See, this is what we're dealing with, and they really do go after people who expose the crimes of the police and of the whole system, really, because the police can't do this on their own. They have to have the whole system backing them up, and they do. And that, all of that must stop. And that's what we're going to be acting to stop this Tuesday, April 14th, with a day of disrupting business as usual all across the country, because business as usual in America includes police killing black and Latino people, especially again and again and again, and being allowed to get away with it by the whole system, the courts, the media, the politicians. This has got to stop, and we're going to be acting to stop it on Tuesday.
There's an excess of over 100 killings just in March of this year across
the
country.
Yeah, the number was 115, and that was what people were able to find out on a grassroots basis, because no police department anywhere in the country releases this information to the public. You go to the federal level, and they tell you that they don't collect the information.
And even the newspapers aren't reporting all those. Probably about maybe three-quarters of the shootings are reported in local newspapers, because Project Censored has done that research. But then we're finding out that there's another 300 or 400 a year that aren't ever even covered in the newspapers.
Yeah, it really is a thing of, they're trying to keep something from you. They're trying to keep from people how often this happens. Another thing that folks have dug up on a grassroots basis is that so far this year, 92 unarmed people have been killed by police.
But Carl Dix, one of the stories in the last censored book, Project Censored 2015, our 18th top 25 story was on National Database of Police Killings, Aims for Accountability. This is because Dee Brian Burghardt, who was an editor of the Reno News and Review, is a journalism instructor at University of Nevada. He discovered exactly what you were just describing. There was no database. There was no way to find out how this was going on. So there was no information in order to be used to hold police accountable outside of anecdotal information or local information that is not reported or not widely reported outside of the area. Yeah. And it makes it very difficult to mobilize the public to understand the systemic problem we face. You mentioned that right from the get-go, and this is a systemic problem. This is not the few bad apples. This is the barrel.
Yes, exactly. And you know, I salute the brother in Reno who took this up. You know, we took up a similar project about 20 years ago with the Stolen Lives Project to document the reality of widespread loss of life at the hands of those who are sworn to protect and serve. And we really have to look at what's really going on, because this rests on an approach in this society to criminalize whole sections of people, especially black and brown people, and especially young people. Because I say that for young people, it's like you go to school in prisons in the inner cities that are in, go to schools in the inner cities that are like prisons, and then you're on a trajectory and a pipeline to end up in prison, treated like permanent suspects, guilty until proven innocent, if you can survive to prove your innocence. And all too often, we are discovering people who cannot survive to prove their innocence. And just two quick things on this. One is it must stop, and we're acting to stop it on April 14th. And everybody should join us in this. People should go to the website stopmassincarceration.net to find out what's happening in their area and to get involved with it. The other thing I wanted to say is that this is bad. This is a horrific problem in its own right. But it is also a concentration of a broader program of suppression. You know, mass incarceration, all of its consequences. Not only the 2 million plus people in prison, but the 5 million plus former prisoners who are treated like less than full human beings because they were in prison. You know, you go to get a job and they find out you're in prison. You can forget that. You go say, well, let me go back to school and try to improve myself. You go to try to get a government loan to do that. You can't do it. You can't get a loan to start a business. You can't live in public housing. And in many states, they don't even let you vote, even though there aren't any politicians to vote for who really have your interest at heart and are trying to do anything about the situation that you're in. So we have looked at this and looked at the millions of people who are caught up in the criminal justice system and their loved ones and families, and it literally amounts to tens of millions of people in this country whose lives are caught up in that criminal injustice system. And this is why Cornell and I formed the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, because this struck us as people caught up in a slow motion genocide, and one that could become a fast one at any point, and that we had to act to stop it, and to stop it now. And that's what we've been doing from the beginning, and it was on that basis and on that tip that we called for April 14th as a day of disrupting business as usual. Because if business as usual includes this wanton police getting a green light to murder people and getting away with it when they do, and it does, the facts and figures point to that. You know, the many videos of people killed, it's not just Walter Scott.
Now,
when you talk to people about, well, there was the video of someone killed by police, people will come back to you with which one.
Well, indeed, I was just going to mention, Carl Dix, I mean, we're sitting here, you know, talking with you live on air, KPFA, you know, Pacifica Radio. And right now I'm looking, there's a shooting just yesterday, I believe, in Miami Gardens, Florida.
Yeah.
Right? The shooting of a dash cam. Yeah, the Laval Hall, a 25-year-old mentally ill person, a schizophrenic person. It went on. There was just another video this morning that I saw off of Cop Block that was taken by a chopper, a Channel 4 chopper somewhere, where the police had subdued someone and then proceeded to pile on and beat him for minutes. These kind of things, again, like you said, when you say police shooting, which one? I mean, this is an extremely sad state of affairs.
Yes, I mean, and that literally, I had a conversation with somebody, and I was talking about the video of the police killing someone, and they thought I was talking about another video. And then finally they asked me, well, which one are you talking about? And we realized there's so many of them. They're becoming regular occurrences, and that is sickening, that it is a regular occurrence that you see those who are sworn to protect and serve killing someone, you know, on your computer, on video. And this we should really live in a society where those who are entrusted with public security would sooner risk or even lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person, a person who's having a mental episode and they're being called on to help. That's the kind of society we should live in, but it would take a revolution to bring that kind of society into being.
We're speaking with Carl Dix, Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're going to take a brief musical break. And when we come back, Carl Dix, you'll still be with us. We'll also be joined by Jeff Mackler, the director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. We'll be right back.
Yeah, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffins, man, it's ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Living in prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're speaking, they just listening, absorbing. I've been doing
this is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We are joined by Carl Dix, associated with so many social justice movements, co-founder of the Revolutionary Communist Party, writing for Revolution Newspaper, part of the Stop and Frisk Stopping the Stop and Frisk program with Dr. Cornell West. And we're also joined now on air by Jeff Mackler, the director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we want to bring Jeff in here now to briefly talk about what's been happening with Mumia. There have been some new things happening with Mumia and Mumia's health, and there are several calls to action that I know that are going to be going on around the United States. Jeff Mackler, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you, and Carl, glad to be with you too.
Yeah, good to be on the air with you, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, a couple of weeks ago, Mumia didn't wake up, which he has woken up for all of the 34 years that he's been in prison, when they call rolls, so to speak. And they punished him for that. He was in a state of lethargy, and they docked him from going into the yard for 2 weeks, cut out his canteen privileges, and otherwise punished him. They didn't bother asking why he couldn't get up, why he was in a semi-stupor 2 weeks ago, but no less than a few days later, in treating him for a terrible case of eczema where his skin is totally swollen and bloodied, they gave him the wrong medication, and that put him into a terrible state. In addition to that, his blood sugar level went up to 779, which is 21 points below the diabetic coma, which as is often associated with death. He was in diabetic shock, so they quickly shipped him to a public or a publicly located medical facility outside of his SCI Mahoney prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania. And there, we had no idea he was there except for the fact that the National Lawyers Guild, Heidi Boghossian, executive director, happened to have set a visit at that point in the prison. When she got there, Mumia wasn't there. And she rushed over to the hospital and actually snuck up the back stairs, and there was Mumia chained to the bed, surrounded by officers, unconscious, in diabetic shock, and according to the doctors, 10 minutes within death, or likely death when your blood sugar. For those newcomers, if you're the normal range is 80 to 120, 140 is considered high. 800, you're dead. And of course, this had, no one knew, there were no blood tests, that Mumia had diabetes, although we're now finding out that this is endemic to prisoners who are fed extremely high sodium and high carbohydrate diet. His sodium level was 189, which is also near execution level. So the doctors treated him initially, and they banned all family members as usual. We had a giant fight and mobilization at the hospital, and 100 people showed up. And the result was his family was allowed to visit, his wife, Wadia, and his son. And then they said, you can't visit but once a week. So we had a big fight about that, and there was so much publicity attendant to it, that they shipped him back to the infirmary. Maria tried to get out of bed in the infirmary, chained, of course, and he fell unconscious for 45 minutes. Still, his blood sugar was in the 350 range. So we are demanding that Mumia have the right to call in his own experts in endocrinology, diabetes, and related diseases. We want to see the medical records. We want to know, and we're not exaggerating when we say, is this yet another effort to execute Mumia? Now, your listeners might say, now, here's a classical Pacifica exaggeration. Police don't try to kill prisoners. And yet, Mumia was shot in 1981 in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia in the chest by a police officer when he tried to rescue his brother, who was being mercilessly beaten. He was near dead. They put him on a stretcher. They rammed his head into a steel lamppost. They threw him into a van. They beat the hell out of him at that point. And then they still couldn't kill him, so they took him into the hospital. They left him alone, where two police officers, one literally standing on the drainage bag, tried to force the fluids back into his body. And, of course, that began the 30-some-odd-year battle to try to stop the execution. Legally, they tried three times and ordered his execution, and the mass movement that we built here in California and everywhere in the United States, in Philadelphia and nationally, stopped three orders of execution until we finally demonstrated in court that the instructions that the racist judge, and I say the racist, quote, I'm going to help him fry the nigger Sabo, which is what he said in his anteroom to another judge and taken down by a court stenographer. They tried three times to execute him. Sabo gave the jury the wrong instructions, and it took us 30 years to get him off death row. So he's now in Frackville, and once again, we fear for his life by medical default. I wouldn't say neglect, because neglect is too modest a word. I think that they are out to put this man away. Of course, he's still fighting another battle. They want to silence Mumia. So the state of Pennsylvania has literally passed a law, which the governor says he will sign, that makes it a crime for, say, Pacifica Radio to broadcast Mumia Abu-Jamal's speeches if they would be offensive to his victims. This holds for any prisoner.
We're speaking with Jeff Mackler, the Director of Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Carl Dix, let's bring you back into the conversation for a moment here. You know, police killings, of course, are grossly underreported. Washington's blog last month wrote a big piece on this. Once upon a time, Americans believed that they were nine times more likely to be killed by a police officer than terrorists. And The Guardian reports that actually people are 55 times more likely to be killed by police than by so-called terrorists. Carl Dix, perhaps we're labeling the wrong groups terrorists?
Exactly, because what is going on is police terror. I mean, think about it. In the old days, you know, in the Jim Crow days, they would lynch a black person. You know, a mob would grab him, hang him, torture him or her, because they lynched women too, and then leave the body hanging to deliver a message to everybody else that this could happen to them. Well, today, it's the police who do that, and they do it in such a way that it delivers a message. Think about Michael Brown, gunned down by Darren Wilson, with his body left to lay in the street for 4.5 hours, you know, with everybody standing around watching, with a police dog coming up and urinating on his body. This was to deliver a message to everybody else of what the system considered their lives to be worth. And it's been very important, one, just to tie it into the point that Jeff was making about Mumia. Mumia was targeted by the police because he exposed what the police and the whole system was doing to black people in Philadelphia. That's why they targeted him. And for somebody to say the police or the prisons wouldn't try to kill somebody, it just shows they don't know how law enforcement works in this society, because it often does work to kill people. Look at the video from South Carolina, and then think about things are done in such a way that it does deliver a message to everybody else. This could happen to you if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. This is illegitimate and unacceptable. People really do need to stand behind Mumia and act to save him in this situation, because I do see execution by medical malfeasance as what's happening. And people need to come out on April 14th and say murder at the hands of the police and the whole concentration of a genocidal program of suppression targeting especially black and Latino people must stop. April 14th, act everywhere. We're calling on everybody to be out there, and people are responding. Here in New York, Cornel West is going to be in the streets, Eve Ensler, Reverend Calvin Butts, and about a dozen, at this point, family members of police murder victims, but the list keeps growing. And it's going to be similar in places across the country. Everybody needs to be out, and people should go to the website, stopmassincarceration.net, for the plans for what's happening, for materials to download so that they can spread the word online and in hard copy and bring others out.
Jeff Mackler, could you chime in momentarily? What's going on here in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Well, for you Pacifica Radio listeners, we have a demonstration on Saturday, April 11th at 12 noon at the Oakland Federal Building, 13th and Clay in downtown Oakland. That's right near the BART stop. And we're calling on everybody to join us in the streets in solidarity with the nationwide protests for Mumia Abu-Jamal. I have to say that Mumia is far from out of it, but just today he issued a commentary in solidarity with the family of Walter Scott, as Carl said, the person who was gunned down. And this kind of action is the norm. You should know that Mumia was targeted for murder because he was the leading radio commentator who was criticizing the Philadelphia Police Department, who was indicted by the FBI and the Justice Department for criminal behavior, with several cops going to jail. And when we covered this as a radio commentator, the chief of police at that time, who became the mayor, Frank Rizzo, said Mumia will be held accountable for his actions. That is accountable for exposing what the federal government was prosecuting: police corruption, police falsification of evidence.
Jeff Mackler, we're going to need to
and drugs.
Interrupt here. We are going to play that statement from Mumia. I wanted to kind of conclude. The state of South Carolina is, in fact, has indicted Michael Slager, charges of murder. But I think what both of you are saying is that's not enough. We have a system, a nationwide system of police repression, incarceration, criminal justice system that is what Michelle Alexander called the new Jim Crow. Certainly, that is something that needs to be addressed in a broader way, and these rallies that you're both talking about will seem to be doing that.
Let me bring in the details for the San Francisco-Oakland area on April 14th.
Okay, we only have about a minute left, so go ahead, Carl.
Okay, 1 p.m., Oscar Grant Corner, 14th and Broadway in Oakland, and in San Francisco, 12 noon, 24th and Mission, San Francisco City Hall. You can email for more information, stopmassincarcerationbayarea@gmail.com, and you could call area code 510-404-3628. That's 510-404-3628.
Carl Dix, thank you so much for joining the show today. We appreciate what you're doing, and thank you for giving us the updates. Jeff Mackler, thank you also for taking time out to join the program today. So despite his medical condition, Mumia Abu-Jamal recorded a new commentary addressing the police killing of Walter Scott. And here we share that commentary with you.
Of punks, predators, and pigs, a South Carolina cop, Michael Slager, opens up on an unarmed black man, Walter Scott. 8 times he shoots. The 50-year-old man drops like a stone in the sea and drifts into eternity. Scott a former officer of the U.S. Coast Guard and father of four, had initially been stopped for a busted traffic light. The cop wrote a detailed report saying he was attacked by Scott, who tried to steal his taser. And then the video appeared, and everything changed. Well, almost everything. Flagger's been busted. That's rare. But remember the young man who allegedly shot, not killed, two cops in Ferguson several weeks ago? Every politician in America leaped at the chance to call the kid a punk, a thug. Now, what do you call Slager? What have you heard? Even though he's been fired, he's called Officer Today, or Mr. Slager. He killed a man for a traffic citation and lied about it. Is he a punk, a predator, or what Huey P. Newton used to call a pig? From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
This is Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. After this musical break, we'll continue our theme today on the rise of the police state in the prison industrial complex. We'll be joined by Maya Shenhua of Truth Out, and we'll be discussing her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Stay with us. Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue today's theme on the rising police state, and we'll be looking here in the last segment of the show on the prison industrial complex, and we are joined by Maya Shenhua. We're going to talk about her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. And here's Peter to introduce Maya to you.
Maya Shenhua is an editor-in-chief of Truth Out, an independent social justice news website. In addition to Truth Out, she has written about the prison industrial complex for the New York Times, The Guardian, the New Jersey State Legislature, Ms. Magazine, Prison Legal News, and others. She's a recipient of the Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Chi Award and a Landon Residency Fellowship for her writings on prisons. Maya, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to ask you, as I was going through the notes on your new book, you talk about decarcerization. What do you mean by that? What are your goals here?
Well, I think right now there's a lot of conversation around the size of the prison system. 2.4 million people in prison. We're the most incarcerated nation in the world. All of this. But a lot of the reforms being proposed to deal with the size of the prison system don't actually shrink it. They reform it in other ways. They may improve conditions. They may create new jails because of overcrowding. But they're not actually shrinking the size of the system. So when I talk about decarceration, I'm actually talking about a fundamental decrease in the size of the whole prison industrial complex. So instead of creating drug treatment jails or mental health jails to deal with the fact that we have mentally ill people or people addicted to drugs living in our prison system, I want to think about ways to not incarcerate them in the first place or to let them out.
Maya Shenhua, your book is Locked Down, Locked Out. People can find out more about it. Barrett Kohler, of course, you're at truthout.org. You divide the book into a couple segments. You begin with something that you call Into the Whole, and then you have a section called Coming Apart and Coming Together. We want to kind of do an overview of some of that with you highlighting these points. But what do you mean Into the Whole when you start the book this way?
So the whole represents solitary confinement. It's kind of the slang term for solitary confinement, usually within county jails. And what it is it's just a barren cell that one person only can be inside. No amenities, nothing. It's often very dark. The person is often barred from seeing other prisoners while they're inside, given very, very, very limited contact with the outside. And this is an extreme version of prison. We know even the UN has completely denounced solitary confinement, called it torture. And certainly more and more, even politicians are speaking up about solitary confinement. But I want to call attention to the fact that a lot of the problems with solitary confinement are just more extreme versions of what's going on with prison as a whole. The isolation, the way in which people are cut off from families and communities on the outside, the denial of resources, the denial often of basic needs. These are things that happen within prison as a whole as well. So when I talk about into the whole, I'm really talking about isolation. I'm talking about going into a place where people are not only cut off from the outside world, but the outside world is very easily able to ignore them. They're in effect erased, and that's what prison does.
So you talk about people absolutely disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Research has shown that we did last year shows that in the city and county jails, over 700 people a year are dying, often mm-hmm. within the first few weeks of being incarcerated. That's another way of disappearing people, I would
think.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and I think that is one thing that definitely gets erased, especially when the people who go in are sick, which is very often the case, and don't have many resources, people who are poor, which is most of the people in the system. Because the prison system kind of relies on the assumption that the people incarcerated within it do not have a lot of resources, don't have a lot of contacts they can call when something terrible is happening to them, don't have a lot of support or strong advocacy on the outside. So when you think about that this system actually is able to survive because of that, because of an assumption that the people within it are able to be repressed or weakened or cut off from advocacy, that's pretty scary.
You write a lot about the impact on the families, and not only the isolation of prisoners where their families just often are not visiting them, but mm-hmm. the impacts on children and spouses. And could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, definitely. I think the impact on family sometimes gets kind of overlooked because people see it as just this limited kind of emotional and psychological impact. And of course, we shouldn't discount that aspect. I had a family member in prison, and it's extremely powerfully draining and tragic, really, because it's very difficult to maintain any sort of meaningful contact with the person. But beyond that, there are a lot of really concrete impacts. So, for example, financially, most people going to prison, again, are from poor families. Very often the person who is being incarcerated is a primary wage earner in the family. So when they go to prison, often that family has to start from scratch, has to make a new plan for survival. And when you think about people being in situations where they're maybe verging on homelessness, not able to put food on the table, what are their choices for where to turn? So we're putting people in even more desperate circumstances. I think that's something to keep in mind when we see prison as sort of a route to safety, which a lot of people still do. Another aspect definitely is the way in which children are impacted, because kids are really the people most impacted when adults are incarcerated. Most people in prison have children. In fact, the majority have minor children, children under 18, and when their parents are incarcerated, they're very often uprooted from their homes. They may go live with a family member. They may know that family member. They may not. They may not like that family member. That person might be abusive. Often, they're not able to live with a family member at all, and they're pushed into the foster care system. And the foster care system, we talk a lot about the school-to-prison pipeline. Well, foster care is definitely also a pipeline to prison. We see that within the prison system as a whole, 80% of people inside have spent some time in the foster care system. So we just see that by sending parents to prison, we're creating this kind of cycle.
We're speaking with author Maya Shenhwar. Her book, Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya, I wanted to ask you, what drove you to this subject to write a book, and what kind of challenges did you face when you were putting this together?
Well, I've been writing about this topic for over a decade as a journalist, and simultaneously I've been relating to it as a family member because my sister has been in and out of jail and prison. And this was always something that I had trouble reconciling as a journalist, because I had this thing inside me that said, you have to be an objective reporter. You can't talk about your personal situation. And then the last time my sister went to state prison, this was in 2012, something clicked in me, and I said to myself, you know, you're being dishonest if you don't discuss your personal story, if you don't disclose this thing going on with you. Because especially at the time, now there's starting to be a lot more awareness, I think, but especially at the time, this was not a subject that was talked about very often in mainstream circles, and it was pretty taboo. And I felt like by talking about my family's situation in the context of research, in the context of reporting, I could put a little more of a personal edge on it and bring people closer to the issue. So that's what I tried to do with the book. And as a result, the book was, in addition to, I hope, putting something meaningful into the world, it was very personally meaningful for me. It was a real kind of process of discovery for me and my family. I would say that in terms of the challenges, a lot of them were bound up with the personal nature. While I was writing the book, a lot of things happened personally that I just stopped and I thought, how can I write this? This is too painful. While I was writing the book, actually, my sister went back to state prison and she was pregnant. And so we knew at that point that she was going to have her baby behind bars and then be separated from her baby. And I talked to her about it and said, you know, can I put this in my book? And she was very, very happy for me to do that. She wanted to get the word out about what was happening to her and so many other mothers. So writing that chapter, I started crying like every 10 minutes. It was such a sad story. But at the same time, I think that only by telling our personal stories and conveying that people in prison are people, it sounds simple, but a lot of people that just hasn't gotten through to them, only by doing that are we going to make real substantive progress on this issue.
Maya, hi. You talk about restorative justice and transformative justice.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference, and why is this so important?
Well, restorative and transformative justice are both forms of seeking justice that happen outside of this prison mindset. So they're not about confining, isolating, separating and disappearing people. So I think that's something crucial that distinguishes both of them. And instead of doing that, instead of focusing on isolation and confinement, both of them focus on bringing people together, on building community instead of breaking it down. Restorative justice is often very focused on bringing the so-called victim, the person, sometimes the parties are not even this distinguishable, but often there's a person who's been harmed, a victim, and a perpetrator, someone who has done harm in situations where you're using restorative justice. And so restorative justice brings the two parties together along with a lot of other affected people. So families, community members, friends, other people who've been touched by this incident that's occurred. And they come together and they tell their stories. They tell the stories leading up to the incident. The perpetrator talks about why they did what they did. And the victim talks about how it affected them. And the perpetrator has to listen to that and hear the weight of that impact. And the goal, many times, of restorative justice is to come to some kind of accountability agreement. And the way that works is that all together, but with an emphasis always on the wishes of the victim, they come to some sort of agreement for what the perpetrator, the person who's done harm, can do to work toward making amends, to work toward repairing harm that's been done to the extent that that can happen. And so this can take all kinds of forms. Sometimes it might involve monetary restitution. Sometimes it might involve years of work on the part of the perpetrator working at some task that the victim deems meaningful. Sometimes it might be a formal public apology that might be part of this. Sometimes victims have asked perpetrators to promise them and follow through on getting counseling. You know, there are all kinds of things. And the goal here is, first of all, to provide some sense of real justice and healing for the victim, but also to work toward preventing future harm. And that's built into this process, I think, in a way that the courts are not concerned with to the same extent. The court is more concerned with punishment. In terms of transformative justice, it shares a lot of elements with restorative justice. I think one distinguishing characteristic definitely is that while restorative justice is sometimes used in conjunction with the criminal legal system, like sometimes restorative justice programs will work in conjunction with police, that kind of thing, transformative justice takes place wholly outside of the state. So it's not, it's a justice solution that's grounded in the community as opposed to facilitated by the state. And that's the distinguishing characteristic. Transformative justice also is kind of, I think, a more flexible phenomenon in that it is not tied to kind of some sort of resolution between the victim and the perpetrator. In fact, sometimes it says, you know, this is not a situation where the victim ever wants to see the perpetrator again. It kind of stemmed from how do we respond to sexual assault, for example, in a restorative justice framework. Maybe we can't. Maybe the victim doesn't want to see the perpetrator. So we have to look for these more kind of creative solutions.
We're speaking with journalist and author Maya Shenhwar. Her book, Locked Down, Locked Out. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. After this brief musical break, we'll be back with Maya Shenhwar to talk about envisioning a future beyond imprisonment. Stay with us. Listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with journalist and author Maya Shenhwar. Her book, Locked Down, Locked Out. Of course, Maya Shenhwar is also the editor-in-chief at truthout.org. Maya Shenhwar, we wanted to take this very last 6-7 minutes we have. We want to talk about your ideas, You write about envisioning a future beyond imprisonment. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think that a world beyond imprisonment can't happen tomorrow. You know, I think that's kind of the first thing that we have to grasp, is that people who call for moving beyond prison are not saying, tear down all the prison walls tomorrow and then we'll be good. We're saying a couple of things. One, at the beginning of this interview, we talked about decarceration. I think that it's important to emphasize that we can't build a different system and keep the current system standing. So we have to strategically chip away at the current system. And a lot of that has to happen on the local level, on the community level and the state level. So there's not going to be some federal law that passes that says, okay, we're going to cut back and we're only going to have one prison per state. That's never going to happen, you know. So I think that this is about communities saying, we don't want to expand our jail. This happened in New Orleans a few years ago. They said, we want a population cap on the parish prison. And they won that population cap, which put a limit on the number of people that could be incarcerated in that jurisdiction. Another example, in Illinois, there was a campaign to close the Supermax prison that was successful a few years back. And that's an example of a situation where the community and really the whole state united, activists, people behind bars, family members, united in saying, you know, we don't need a Supermax prison in our state. Keeping people in solitary confinement is wrong. We're going to come together and actually do this thing that's going to shrink the system in Illinois. And so that prison closed down. They were also successful in closing down a women's prison in the state. Reducing mandatory minimum sentences, so reducing the number of years that a person is sentenced to for a certain crime. All of these things that make the system smaller, this type of chipping away, that's all essential. And it requires a number of people playing all kinds of different roles in their communities across the country. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is to crowd out the prison system with all kinds of other solutions. So it's, you know, when you say we want to decarcerate, we want to reduce the number of prisons and the prison budgets and all this, we're not saying we don't need any mechanisms to deal with violence, but we are saying the mechanisms being perpetrated by the state right now actually are violent, and they're not preventing violence. So we need to create our own measures. And this is where restorative justice, transformative justice, all of these creative solutions that people come up with for dealing with violence in their communities, that's where these come in. And the more those creative solutions are built up, the more people are not going to call the police. People are not going to involve the system in the first place. And that's another route, I think, to moving beyond prison, because oftentimes it is individuals choosing to get the state involved that sets off that cycle. So it's kind of those twin processes of decarceration, of chipping away at the system, everyone thinking strategically about how to break that down, at the same time as building up these other strategies and thinking about how can we reduce harm and address violence in a long-lasting way that builds community. And so with those two together, I have no doubt that we are moving toward a world beyond imprisonment.
We certainly think that's an important part. I think one of the things that really strikes me about your writings is this idea that the prisons are so a system of isolation, not just solitary confinement, but the entire mechanism is to isolate individuals from any human kindness,
right?
Family love, individual children and people that care about them, and it ends up creating someone who's really been wronged and hurt beyond what they've done to others.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that actually at this point, a lot of social scientists who study this issue are saying that prison is criminogenic, that it causes crime. We see this with people persistently coming back to prison. Two-thirds of people coming out of prison are rearrested in 3 years. And it is, part of it is that concept of hurt people hurt people. People go to prison, we hurt them by cutting them off from everyone they've ever loved and also subjecting them often to physical violence and sexual violence and all the things that authorities perpetrate behind bars. And then we're springing them out into the community again with no support, and we're saying, here, we've hurt you further, now don't mess up.
Well, Maya Shenhua, we want to thank you for joining us today. We certainly thank you for your book. It's been praised. Your book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, editor-in-chief at truthout.org. You've received praise from Angela Davis, Dennis Kucinich, Bill Ayers, Henry Giroux, Michelle Alexander, again, Kathy Kelly. We certainly hope folks might go and take a look at the important research and work that Maya Shenhua has done. Maya, thanks so much for joining the program.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Here is my co-host Peter Phillips. We have a few announcements.
Palestinian nonviolent activist Iyad Bernat will be visiting Sonoma County on Tuesday, April 14th. He's at Sonoma State University at 4 p.m. at the Student Union Building, and then later that night at the Glacier Center at 7 p.m. Iyad Bernat is the leader of the Popular Committee in Baleen, Palestine, a small farming village in the occupied West Bank. He will tell his story and what has been happening there.
We have two announcements regarding the Mumia Abu Jamal events and Stop Mass Incarceration Network. If you're in the Bay Area, Saturday, April 11, there's an event at noon at the Oakland Federal Building. No execution by medical default. And there's also a day of action, April 14th, Stop Business as Usual. This is from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You can find out more about them online, Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with co-host Peter Phillips. You can also visit the Project Censored website, projectcensored.org. We have a couple of great studies about police and imprisonment, Nolan Higdon's Justice for Sale and Peter Phillips' study on justifiable harm. Homicides. The Project Censored Show airs on 22 stations around the U.S. For more information or listen to archives and previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fess is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time. Stay tuned for Terra Verde.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
KPFA has launched an Indiegogo campaign to raise $100,000 for improvements to our building. Over the last 24 years, there's been a lot of wear and tear to our radio station, and we haven't always had the money to fix or even mend a lot of our problems. Over those years, we've told the truth about historical moments of political impasse, racial tensions, and economic inequality. To continue the fight, we have to update our studio equipment, repair our tattered offices, and last but not least, repair or replace our elevator. Please join KPFA's Community Building Campaign. Here's how you can help. Go to our website, www.kpfa.org, and click the link to our Indiegogo video. Then please donate. No amount is too small. Share the link with your network of friends and family through Facebook, Twitter, and email. Please help your community-powered station so we can continue our mission to speak truth to power. Thank you.
Hello, this is Angela Glover Blackwell, founder and CEO at PolicyLink. I am thrilled to invite you to an event with Ajin Poo, where she will present her powerful new book, The Age of Dignity, and explain how to harness our nation's age wave to build a caring economy that benefits all of us. Ajin is a MacArthur Genius Award winner and director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Join us on Sunday, April 26, 7:30 p.m. at the Asian Cultural Center located at 388 9th Street in Oakland. Mitch Jeserich and I will host this KPFA benefit. There is wheelchair access. Tickets are available at brownpapertickets.com and at many supportive bookstores. Please visit KPFA.